We're discussing what bystanders can do when someone is getting assaulted or harassed. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer, Kent. Anti-Asian hate crimes have dramatically increased in the pandemic. The violence has sparked discussions like the one we're having now about what bystanders can do to help safely stop it in the moment. Have you witnessed a harassment situation where you had to intervene? Was there a situation where you regret not intervening? 800-642-1234. Gabriela Mejia is a trainings and communications associate for Hollaback. It's a nonprofit working to end street harassment and harassment in all its forms. Gabriela, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hello, welcome. Thank you for welcoming.
Yes. Your organization over the years has trained more than 38,000 people in bystander intervention tactics. Does it work?
We found it does work to empower people and to make them feel like they can intervene in ways that are safer and that are going to keep the person who's being harassed safe.
What have you found in these trainings as you train so many thousands of people in this work? What have they told you about what they want to be able to do?
I've heard some concerns, and we really do want to center the tools that we share with people around those concerns, which can be around safety. It can be around sharing the same identity as the person who's being harassed and not knowing what to do. We created a set of bystander tools to share with those people that address concerns of safety and de-escalate situations.
We're going to be getting to those tools, those tactics in just a moment. But I want to find out first, especially in the pandemic, there's been a documented dramatic rise in anti-Asian hate crimes and violence. How has your organization responded?
So we actually, because we do collect stories of harassment, we did see an increase in stories being shared with us by members of the Asian community last March. And throughout this past year, we work with our partners at Asian Americans Advancing Justice, AAJC, to create a training specifically to respond to that increase. So we created a training called Bystander Intervention in the Face of Anti-Asian, Asian American Harassment. And over the past year, we trained 16,000 people, which we were pretty proud to be able to offer that. But over the past month, we saw 50,000 people register for our training.
Wow.
So definitely this spike has led to a lot of people wanting to show up.
What's been the response to these trainings? How do people feel afterward?
We actually do exit surveys, of course, and we found that over 97% of people say that they feel like they could at least do one thing in response to harassment if they were to witness it right after. So I think the overall response has really been really positive, and people are relieved to know that there are tools that they that are available to them and are simple and approachable.
Well, let's talk about the tools, the intervention, the tactics that you are trying to teach. There are these five D's that you teach about. Can you explain them?
Right. I can certainly explain them. I do a lot of sharing these tools. So I personally found them really helpful. So I can go through them. We call them the five D's of bystander intervention. And we made them all start with a D to make them easy to remember, because we want these to be easy to remember in those moments when maybe you might freeze. So the first D is distract, and it is to create a distraction to bring an end to the harassment. And what we're doing with any of these D's is showing up in support. So what we want to make sure is that your distraction brings an end to the harassment. That can be going up to the person who's being harassed and asking them for the time and building community with them so that they're not alone and not this easy target. You can also go up to them and pretend you know them and give them an out of that situation. You can let them know, hey, how have you been? How's your mom? Are you busy right now? Do you want to get out of here? And you can give them a chance to step away of perhaps a situation that is escalating. Then the next D is delegate, which is pretty simple, but often, even it's happened to me, we forget. And delegate is to ask for help. You can ask for help from other bystanders who are noticing something is wrong, but are maybe stuck in inaction. Or you can ask for help from someone in a position of authority, like a store manager, a security guard, a flight attendant.
Yeah, so someone around you who might be able to do something to also intervene.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's folks' job to de-escalate situations. They may be trained in it in a way that may be helpful for the situation. Or they're just a position of authority. So like a teacher in a classroom can de-escalate a situation pretty more easily than perhaps a student. So I also want to stress that other bystanders, once other people are involved, that usually helps situations de-escalate because more people involved keeps that person safe and brings light to the situation. So delegate, really, you have a few options there. The next D is document, which is pretty instinctual to a lot of us nowadays. It can mean taking your phone out, taking that picture or that video. But I do want to stress that there are important tips to make sure you're going to be supportive in your documentation, which the first tip is that if the harassment is ongoing, you should combine it with delegate. You should be bringing the harassment to an end and then taking that photo to or that video to help that person who's being harassed not feel like they're just being made a spectacle of or being stared at. And with documentation, we stress also that you give it to the person who's been harassed. That way, they can then use it to report, they can choose to share it on social media, or they can keep it to their private files because harassment is pretty traumatic. So maybe they don't want anyone else to see it on social media. So it should be up to them to make that choice. And when you hand it over to them, you text it over, you send it over, email it over, you're going to be the most helpful to them and most supportive. Our fourth D,
I was just going to jump in here, and before we go to the next D, and just to reintroduce, you're talking with Gabriela Mejia, who is a trainings and communication associate for Hollaback. It's a grassroots organization aimed at ending street harassment, giving us tactics and tools this morning to be able to be a bystander who can do something in these moments. Have you been in a situation like this where you've had to intervene in harassment in a particular situation that was escalating? What did you do? 800-642-1234. Gabriela, what is that next D?
The next D, our fourth D, is delay. And I usually, when I train folks on this, and we do train folks for free on our website, I will later on say this, which is that delay is my superpower. It's my favorite D. And delay is to simply, after the harassment has ended, go up to the person who's been harassed and take care of them. So that can be letting them know, hey, I saw what happened. It wasn't right. It's not acceptable. What can I do right now to make you feel safe? What do you need from me? And what we found with our research with Cornell University is that as little as a knowing glance from a stranger can have this positive healing effect from the trauma of harassment for the person who's been harassed. So if as little as a knowing glance is pretty powerful in helping someone, your words are very powerful in helping them not internalize what just happened to them or think that it was in any way their fault. So use those words that are probably already in your head or in your heart when you witness something, and say them out loud, share them, make sure you're taking care of that person. Our final D is direct. And all the other Ds, the four I just shared, are indirect actions. You're not addressing the harassment directly in the moment. But of course, with direct, that is the D where we want you to, if you feel safe enough to do that, if you've assessed your safety and you feel like, yes, I can say something directly right now, go up to that person who's doing the harassing, tell them, name the behavior they're doing, ask for it to stop, and that's the end of your conversation with them. in this moment, you're showing up in support. So I want to stress that you should then turn around and take care of that person who's been harassed. You don't want to get into a back and forth, into an argument, or any kind of conversation with the person who's doing the harassing, because you're not showing up for that. That could escalate things if you don't handle it, if you're not used to handling situations like that. So what I want you to do is just very clearly be firm, clear, and final with the sentence that you say to them. If your mind goes blank in these situations, I would suggest calling out what it is. Tell them, can you please stop harassing this person? Or what you're doing is harassment, please stop. And that can be empowering.
We are talking about what to do if we witness a hate incident with Gabriela Mejia of Holla Back. It's a grassroots organization working to root out harassment in all its forms. What do you want to know about bystander intervention? Have you been trained in de-escalation tactics? What would you like to share? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Gabriela Mejia here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the five D's of bystander intervention and how to prevent violence and help out in the moment. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. The organization Holla Back has trained more than 38,000 people in how to intervene when they see harassment happen. Have you witnessed a harassment situation where you had to intervene? Have you been targeted with catcalls or suggestive comments? What did you do or a bystander do, and how did it make you feel? Join in 800-642-1234. Gabriela Mejia of Holla Back is with us for 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Marcus now from Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus. What would you like to share?
Good morning. So I've taught Taekwondo in the Milwaukee metropolitan area for a number of years. I'm no longer affiliated with any school, but I still teach to anybody who I feel will benefit from it. One of the things that we tried to stress through the different dojos was that don't be a bystander, meaning don't stand there and just look on and gawk. If nothing else, yell, hey, do something, but don't be a bystander. Help resolve the situation, because if we're honest, every single one of us, without a doubt, has at some time felt that we've been attacked, that we could have, you know, somebody could have come to our aid, where someone has come to our aid. And so be that positive influence. I think as a species, if we can be human and kind and be both at the same time, I think we'd really have something, Kate.
Oh, Marcus, thank you for that. Gabriela, what do you make of that? Marcus saying, just do something.
I, of course, agree with that. And like Marcus shared, I personally feel like I've been in both roles. I've been in the role of where I wanted someone to help me, because like a lot of folks in the harassment work, I've been harassed, and that's what brings me and makes me care about the work. But I've also been there where we freeze, and that is just much too common. But it's also not what is most natural to us. We like to share that bystander intervention, we didn't come up with it. It is a natural thing we're all doing all the time for each other. When we see something go wrong, we step up and take care of each other in really small ways where we don't even think about it. So I think it's within all of us to be active bystanders.
Gabriela, I keep thinking about the teenage bystander who took the witness stand recently in Derek Chauvin's trial, and her video circulated around the world. Darnella said on the witness stand, "It's been nights. I've stayed up apologizing and apologizing to George Floyd for not doing more and not physically interacting and not saving his life." What would you say about the crushing weight of guilt a bystander feels when a situation is out of their control or they regret not doing something differently?
I think we can all recognize that, you know, in the example you've shared, that situation was out of her control. But what I want us to put a light on is the fact that that documentation, that recording, is bringing justice. right? Mm-hmm. It's helping on that road. It's being helpful still, even though you couldn't do what was really out of your control in that moment. You were still active and helpful, and you're still making a change by doing something, just at least one thing in response to that. Even if you can't end the situation or de-escalate it all by yourself, you can still help out.
Along those lines, when police are involved on the scene, how does Hollaback's bystander intervention training address situations that do involve police officers?
So we do have we did see the need and created a training specifically called Bystander Intervention to Stop Police-Sponsored Violence and Anti-Black Racist Harassment. And in it, we really go into the nuance of a situation like that, where the ways that 5D show up may be different. But something I want to stress in talking about police intervention in situations of harassment is to make sure that you are, if you're documenting, you're keeping a safe distance. And if you are choosing to delegate in the face of harassment and you want to ask for help from the police, I want you to go up to the person who's being harassed and ask them, do you want me to call the police? And that's just a pretty simple question that you can always ask. And then I want you to respect what that person tells you. Because if you call the police and they say, yes, you can do that, then you can support them that way. But if you decide to call the police against their wishes, you may be increasing the trauma that they're experiencing in the face of harassment. So I think we all want to be conscious that we're showing up to support someone. So calling the police may not be the best option for some folks in terms of delegating a situation.
We're talking with Gabriella Mejia of Hollaback. It's a grassroots organization aimed at ending street harassment and harassment in all forms. Still time to talk about this. Have you had to intervene or de-escalate in a harassment situation? What was that situation and what did you do in the moment? 800-642-1234. Gabriella, we heard from Deborah, who called in, couldn't stay with us. Deborah adopted her daughter from China and worries about her daughter's safety and wonders what she should do. She wonders how she can help protect her daughter, but also feel like her daughter can be out in the world alone.
I think it's never an easy question to answer, especially when it comes from parents talking about children or about their even grown adult children. I think what you can do is be informed, stay informed about the spikes in incidents. Learn bystander intervention. If you're ever out with your daughter, I want you to know how to support your daughter. We also share that it's important to know the history of anti-Asian harassment in the United States, because this is not happening in a vacuum. It's been anti-Asian harassment, anti-Asian hate is really part of American history. So maybe sharing that history, not just with your daughter or learning it for yourself, but sharing it with your community and making sure others in your community can be there to show up for her, that can empower you.
Gabriella, what should bystanders do when a situation turns violent or becomes dangerous?
In terms of when medical attention is needed, of course, we do recommend that you call emergency services. You call your 911, 311. In situations where perhaps you're in with a crowd and no one else is doing anything, or you're all feeling a little stuck, but you are all witnessing something truly escalating, I think those are the situations where you should definitely interact with the people around you. Turn to someone and say, hey, do you see what's happening there? Can you go get help? Turn to someone else and ask them if they can, if they feel comfortable intervening, if you do not feel comfortable doing that yourself. So definitely look for more people to intervene, and that's how situations de-escalate, when more people are involved.
We only have a few seconds left, but where do you find hope in this work?
I find hope in how many people have been joining us, how many people have been searching us out because they want to help. They are maybe Asian themselves, maybe they're not Asian, but they are seeking us. They're taking our trainings, our one-hour trainings, and that is pretty inspiring to me.
Gabriella, thank you for joining us and for this work.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure being here.
Gabriella Mejia is a trainings and communications associate for Hollaback. It's a grassroots organization aimed at ending harassment in all forms. You can find a link at WPR.org/mornings. Coming up, we talk with the Secretary of the State Department of Natural Resources about wildfires, PFAS, wolf hunts, and more. That's after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're talking with the leader of the state DNR, Department of Natural Resources, on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Secretary Preston Cole gave a budget briefing before the Joint Finance Committee last Wednesday. He urged lawmakers to support the governor's budget that calls for $20 million over the next 2 years for the monitoring, the testing, remediation of PFAS, the human-made toxic forever chemicals that are building up in our environment. What are your questions on how the state is handling PFAS contamination and wastewater sampling standards? Do you worry about nitrates and pathogens from runoff? What do you want to ask the DNR head? 800-642-1234. Preston Cole is Secretary of the DNR. Secretary Cole, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. It is always a pleasure to be on one of the largest drive time radio shows in the country. And so thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. Let's start with PFAS. The DNR has identified contamination around the state, dozens of sites, including Campbell, the town near La Crosse on the Mississippi, where the state is offering residents cases of bottled water. Can you tell us about the PFAS problem that you see?
Well, yet another community is encumbered by PFAS in their wells. And certainly the folks on French Island and town of Campbell, you know, may not have seen this coming. And now we've worked with the Air National Guard to provide bottled water in about 200 homes. And again, we understand the fear and, you know, the hesitancy from the folks who live on French Island. But it's just a testament that PFAS continues to wreak havoc in our water systems in many communities around the state of Wisconsin. Our responsibility at the DNR is to leverage using the governor's budget initiative. You know, we're talking one time $10 million each year of the biennium, and following the PFAS action plan that he called for, let's begin in earnest to do what we've done since the 70s. Using our groundwater laws, we've taken approximately 138 chemicals off the landscape. We know exactly how to approach this new harmful chemical. We like to work with industry. We want to continue to work with local fire departments to get these chemicals out of their storerooms. We know that they need assistance. And so this is a public health issue. And again, yet another community, French Island, is encumbered by problems in their drinking water.
Yeah, and when you say we know exactly how to approach this, these are forever chemicals in our environment. They don't go away. How do you approach this problem?
Well, the first is testing.
Appears we just lost Preston Cole here, who is the Secretary of the Department of Natural Resources. We've been talking about PFAS contamination in Wisconsin, and you can join in what you have seen with PFAS, how you want the state to handle PFAS contamination. What what can it be done? How worried are you about these chemicals in drinking water? Join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org as we work to get the secretary of the DNR, Preston Cole, back on the line with us as we talk about a range of issues with the DNR. Did you take part in the recent wolf hunt? Will you sign up for the next one? How should the state manage wolf hunts? What do you want to talk about with the secretary of the DNR? Are you an avid state park visitor? Have you been to any state parks recently? And if so, how are they working? What have you noticed about them amid the pandemic? What questions do you have for the State Department of Natural Resources as it works to preserve natural resources around the state? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org as we work to get Preston Cole, Secretary of the DNR, back on the line. Secretary, are you there?
Yes, I am.
I'm sorry that we lost you there for a moment. You were talking about PFAS and how to approach this problem because you have insights.
Yeah. And again, the PFAS action plan calls for setting the standards around human health conditions. And we rely on our public health officials at the Department of Health Service to give us that information. They've set for groundwater, for example, 20 parts per trillion, which is a small number. We're talking about four drops of PFAS in an Olympic-sized pool that will put you into harm's way. Then we go on to set our sampling regimes about where this chemical is and where it isn't in our water systems and on our land. You know, in Rhinelander, these plumes are far-fetched and into the community, as well as to drinking wells that emanate from the property there. Pollution prevention. And again, community engagement is key to all of this. And of course, the research that's currently going on around these chemicals, we know that there are folks in the industry that are moving away from this AFFF, which is the one that does a myriad of harmful, does harm to the human genome. And again, the technologies around remediating this look like, you know, everything from carbon mitigation to soil remediation and using high temperatures and a myriad of other technologies that are continuing to evolve. So we're excited that we have a roadmap. We just need the funding to begin.
Congressman Ron Kind of Wisconsin helped introduce legislation this week that would require the EPA to establish a national drinking water standard. What do you want out of the federal government on PFAS regulation?
Well, it's time for guidance. And again, myriad of states, you know, I think the number that was set by the previous administration was 70 parts per trillion. And then in Michigan, they have drinking water at something at 8 and groundwater something larger than that. You know, now it's time for us to have a national standard. You know, when we are encumbered with these types of chemicals, it is important for the federal government, for the EPA, to begin setting standards that we all can live by. Those national standards provide a guidepost that on one side of the highway, it could be one state with a high level, and there could be another state on the other side. That means that there's going to be winners and losers in terms of public health. And we need consistency out of our federal government, specifically the EPA, because they do the rulemaking on drinking water and groundwater and those types of activities. So we're hopeful that the new administration will begin in earnest to establish those guidelines for us.
I want to touch here on the business community and the lawsuit with Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce filed against the DNR seeking to block your agency from requiring that certain facilities allow testing of wastewater for PFAS. Do you think the DNR should have the flexibility and authority to test wastewater for any types of contaminants and then deem that it deems necessary?
We believe that our groundwater laws, state statute, as well as our federal laws allow us to do testing in water systems, both wastewater and supply systems, when we are in the process of rulemaking. So we believe we stand on firm ground with that.
Do you think that you should be able to publish the wastewater data that you find?
Well, the court has ordered us to allow for the testing to occur and hold back on when, in fact, those names of companies are then entered into the public record. And so we will wait to hear back from the court and their guidance on a go-forward strategy around that particular issue.
Let's move on to wildfires. And as we've seen this year, hundreds of wildfires in Wisconsin destroying more than 1,500 acres. Governor Evers declaring a state of emergency due to fire conditions in early April. What can you tell us about the devastation?
Well, I will tell you that early in the season with dry grasses, tall grass fields, and of course, cattail ponds that are dry. Last year's, cattails have all dried up, provide a fuel for fire. We know that the high winds that we experienced early in the season led us to approximately well over 320 wildfires and burned approximately 1,400 acres. In Wisconsin, in March, April, and May, it's fire season for us. And currently, as we see grasses begin to green up and leaves become green, it slows it down a bit. However, it's the winds and the burning that continue to harm us. We know that 98% of the fires are caused by humans. These traditionally emanate from burn piles or burn barrels on properties. Sparks get out and ignite. That puts that neighborhood and that community in harm's way as those winds begin to pick up. The approach that we take is that the governor's executive order for that state of emergency, specifically early in our season when we were seeing 40, 50, and 60 mile hour winds, that it allowed us to go on offense and create a circumstance that if we need to call in the Air National Guard for Blackhawks, for extractions and those types of things, because public properties are at stake as well as human life, we then have that ready to go. And luckily, we have a low pressure area sitting on top of Wisconsin right now. While the humidity is still low, we know that these fires can spark at any time as the wind picks up. We're concerned.
Yeah, is this unusual to have so many fires sparked this early in the spring?
And again, it's the weather patterns. And
okay.
We know Wisconsinites are smart. When the wind is over 5 or 10 miles an hour, let's wait. Let's bundle that garbage up. Let's put a cap on those burn piles and not burn when the conditions put us, property and human life, into harm's way. We have to be smart about this, and Wisconsinites are.
We're talking with DNR Secretary Preston Cole. He's with us as we discuss the work of his agency. During the pandemic, park passes and first-time fishing licenses soared. Are you getting outside more? What questions do you have for the DNR about recreation, about hunting, wildfires, other pressing issues dealing with our natural resources? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Secretary Cole here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with DNR Secretary Preston Cole. He's with us for 10 more minutes looking at issues facing the DNR. Let's bring in Jim now in River Falls. Hi, Jim. What's on your mind?
I just had a question. I know the Wisconsin Conservation Congress met this week, and I know there was some proposed language for the DNR to adopt concerning CO2 emissions and becoming carbon neutral because of the climate crisis and the fact that we're having effects of global warming and in the state and around the world. So I'm just wondering if what happened with that vote and if citizens of the state can still have input on that. And then just as an aside too, with water issues and these high capacity wells. I guess that's another question I have, if there's going to be more regulation on that, because certainly water issues around the world are of critical importance, and it's going to be more important every day.
Yeah, Jim, thank you. Secretary Cole, taking the Conservation Congress first.
Yes, the Conservation Congress is a bright light in natural resources in the state of Wisconsin. We're one of the only states that have this type of advisory body to the Natural Resource Board. And certainly, as having been on the Natural Resources Board and now as secretary, I count on their guidance. And it's wonderful to hear that for an organization like the Wisconsin Conservation Congress, that they too understand that climate change is an imminent danger to our livelihoods in this world. And for them to go on record asking for assistance and identifying the substantive nature of what causes it lets me know once again that this is an organization that wants to lead on climate change and make sure that fishers and hunting community and conservation organizations that we all rely on are equally as engaged about what they can do. And high cap wells, we are and can't speak to that particular issue because the Supreme Court is hearing that issue this week, heard briefings this week, and we will wait to hear back from the Supreme Court as to how they render a decision on our role and responsibilities around high cap wells.
Jim, thank you. Emily now in Madison has a question. Emily, hi, go ahead.
Hi, I work for a public library system, and one of the things that I've seen other states do, I believe Colorado is one and Indiana is another, is they have state park passes available for their patrons to check out. I believe over the last year with the pandemic, you know, we've seen articles about how there's been such an increase of people utilizing the state park system, and I was just hoping that that would be something maybe the DNR could help me set up as a way for maybe the state park to be more accessible to more people.
Emily, thank you. Secretary.
I absolutely appreciate the input on that from Emily. State parks were up 42% in terms of our park passes. Park attendance was up 22%. Again, boat registrations. People found a way to get outdoors. It's wonderful for us to hear the excitement around these issues, but also suggestions like Emily has provided. I will ensure that my staff, who are certainly listening to this program today, give us some feedback about opportunities that may exist around participation at with our local library systems. But that said, we know that folks, again, showed up in earnest at our natural areas, our state parks, our boat launches to get outdoors. That's a testament to our stewardship program. And this governor, again, in his budget, authorized another 10 years and $70 million so that we can continue the legacy that stewardship has provided us and provide the spaces necessary that people can get in the outdoors. Wisconsin is special in that way. We should be able to lean in very heavily in this state around capturing lands that would necessarily not get purchased, these unique ecosystems that we all have and all appreciate. But we know here in Wisconsin, our outdoors are part of our economy and natural and outdoor recreation. City, towns, and villages count on people driving to the far reaches around the state to look at these unique ecosystems and get into the outdoors. We believe there's also an economic development piece that stewardship provides. And so we're excited about that conversation that is beginning in earnest with regard to the governor's leading on stewardship and the Joint Finance Committee taking that issue up.
DNR Secretary Preston Cole is with us. Let's move on now to the wolf hunt. This week, your agency started seeking input on how to manage and plan for next fall's wolf hunt. And Russ from Stoughton would like to share his thoughts on it. Russ, hi, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Number one, I was totally against a wolf hunt of any kind. And number two, I was totally inflamed by the DNR's lack of backbone, which, as I understand, was forced to put the wolf hunt from an out-of-state, some out-of-state lawsuit during the mating season, the worst possible time. How do you defend that as wildlife management?
Secretary Cole, you know, the February hunt this year, it exceeded its quota as well. And Russ, you know, really upset about it.
You know, and Russ has every right to be concerned about the wolf hunt and how it occurred. Many Wisconsinites don't realize that when the wolf is delisted, that then triggers a hunt in the state of Wisconsin. And the Department of Natural Resources then begins the planning process. We had proposed in January, after the wolf was delisted, that we begin in earnest and work throughout 2021 to develop the rules, the regulatory framework, the quotas, and we have a significant role with our tribal partners to, they too have something to say about it. And those consultations are important to the laws that we have on the books relative to a wolf hunt. That said, we did not want to go into a wolf hunt haphazardly. And consequently, we did not want to do that. Consequently, we were sued by an organization called Hunter Nation, and that court rendered a decision. The department then appealed, and that appeal was not taken up, and that hunt began in earnest. And that hunt, again, there's the previous administration at the DNR all but buttoned up the wolf program. And what that means is that program basically was put on the shelf because the wolf was delisted. Well, you still have to do the requisite counts, and certainly that occurred, but there's a lot that has to occur. We believe there are substantive statutory changes about reporting your wolf after you've taken that wolf, and other changes that need to be updated as part of a almost 10-year-old, 11-year-old wolf statute. So Russ has every right to be concerned about how this went down. My responsibility and the DNR's responsibility is to fix it.
And we only have a couple seconds left here, but what should happen with the wolf hunt in the fall?
Well, we are in the process of taking public input. And this is the bright light of how we go about our rulemaking. We hear from a lot of people. We have the Wolf Management Plan Committee in play, and we also have a Wolf Quota Committee. Those two groups would advise us, as they always have, whether it's a wolf committee or a bear committee. We count on stakeholders that represent a large amount of, and quite honestly, divergent opinions about wolves. And we then work with them. They issue the Wolf Management Plan, which hasn't been updated since 1999. I think there was a framework of some sort back in 2014. Those plans guide us.
And Secretary Cole, we are out of time. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate. Always a pleasure. Call me whenever.
And this is the Ideas Network.